Today is Wednesday, July 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. More than 90 people are killed after fire ravages a coronavirus treatment center in Iraq.
Eyewitnesses told Iraqi media that oxygen canisters being used to treat COVID-19 patients exploded.
Plus, how well do COVID-19 vaccines work against the Delta variant?
They're very effective in doing what we want them to do, which is protect people from serious illness and death.
We'll have these stories and more next. Iraqi officials say that at least 92 people are dead and more than 50 have been injured after a blaze ripped through a coronavirus treatment center overnight at a hospital in the southern Iraqi city of Nasira. A similar fire tore through a Baghdad hospital in April, killing upwards of 80 people. Edward Uranian starts us off.
Hours after the tragic blaze tore through the poorly constructed COVID-19 treatment center in the southern Iraqi city of Nasiriyah, rescue workers continued to sift through the rubble of the destroyed facility to try and recover dead bodies and identify them. Eyewitnesses told Iraqi media that oxygen canisters being used to treat COVID-19 patients at an annex to the Imam Hussein Teaching Hospital exploded, causing a fire to quickly burn through the facility, leaving few survivors. A health spokesman for Iraq's Zikar province, where the hospital is located, told Arab media the building that caught fire was poorly constructed and the blaze spread very quickly throughout the facility. A young man wearing a red sports cap told Iraqi media the COVID facility was a death trap. He says that when he arrived late Monday night to help pull people out of the fire, he found the doors locked and was unable to get inside the building. An older man expressed his anger at Iraqi government and provincial officials, claiming that a newer Turkish hospital that was officially dedicated last month has yet to accept patients, adding to the tragedy. An old woman who lost several family members screamed as people in the vicinity of the ruined building tried to comfort her. Many victims of the blaze have yet to be identified since their bodies were badly charred. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi accepted the resignations of the health minister and other top health officials, and he is promising a full report on what happened within 1 week. The Iraqi parliament is also scheduled to discuss the tragic fire Tuesday in an afternoon session. Iraq's president, Barham Saleh, said in a tweet Tuesday that the tragic hospital fire, along with the fire several months ago at Baghdad's Ibn Khatib Hospital, were caused by corruption and poor administration among those responsible for the lives of the Iraqi people. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA the corruption that has beset Iraq is indicative of the inability to put together an Iraqi state after the U.S. invasion in 2003. He says this is not the first such fire, and it is a reminder that no one has been able to put together a cohesive government since the U.S. invaded the country in 2003, as Iran is hampering progress on many fronts. Corruption permeates the Iraqi system, he adds, and despite the $80 billion spent on the electricity grid, enough to light the entire Middle East, the country still suffers from lengthy blackouts. In addition to the blackouts, which have left large parts of the country in the dark as summer temperatures top 50 degrees Celsius, Iraq also is battling a resurgent coronavirus pandemic. Various political factions are also trying to undermine Prime Minister Kazemi as October parliamentary elections approach. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Israelis had taken off their masks and shrugged off physical distancing, but now, new restrictions are coming in as the Delta variant takes hold. The government is calling it soft suppression and hopes to avoid another lockdown. Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder is up next.
4 weeks ago, Israel was celebrating a return to normal life. Then along came the more infectious Delta variant of COVID-19. A surge in cases meant a change of course. Israelis had stopped wearing masks and abandoned social distancing after one of the world's fastest vaccination drives. Now it has reinstated the mandatory wearing of face masks indoors and quarantine for all people arriving in Israel. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett calls the policy soft suppression. His government wants Israelis to learn to live with the virus and to develop herd immunity. It plans to impose the fewest possible restrictions and avoid a fourth national lockdown that could further batter the economy. That strategy is drawing parallels with Britain as it lifts all restrictions. Doctors like Gadi Sigal, who heads a coronavirus ward, remain concerned.
We must find the right moment to limit the entry of new mutations from abroad, and the government must find a way to limit further spreading of the virus in the community, because the virus won't stop. It is evolving. It is its nature. But our nature is to survive.
Daily infections are running at about 450, with the Delta variant making up some 90% of cases. About 45 people are in hospital with severe COVID. Around 60% of Israelis have received at least one shot of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. And on Sunday, the government began offering a third shot for those with compromised immunity.
Reuters' Lucy Fielder. Seven COVID-19 vaccines have received the green light thus far from the World Health Organization. And as new variants of the coronavirus evolve, questions have arisen about how well each vaccine works. It can get confusing. But as VOA's Steve Barragona reports, when it comes to keeping people out of the hospital and the grave, any shot will help.
With the Delta variant surging, reports show even some vaccinated people are getting infected with the COVID-19 virus. But those infections are mostly mild. All the vaccines are still working by the most important measure, experts say.
They're very effective in doing what we want them to do, which is protect people from serious illness and death.
A rash of infections in Israel raised concerns recently that some vaccines are weaker against the Delta variant. But Powderly tells VOA the shots are preventing the worst cases, as a surge in his home state of Missouri is showing.
They are seeing infections just like the Israelis saw in people who are vaccinated, but they're not seeing anybody coming into the hospital. All of their hospitalizations and, unfortunately, all of their deaths are in people who have not been vaccinated.
Some of the shots are better than others at priming the immune system. The mRNA vaccines from Moderna and Pfizer generally seem to produce the most antibodies, followed by the viral vector vaccines, Johnson & Johnson, the Oxford University AstraZeneca vaccine, and Russia's Sputnik V. The inactivated virus vaccines from China's Sinovac and Sinopharm are on the lower end of the scale. All of them produce enough antibodies to fight the original strain, but antibody levels start to matter more against the variants, experts say.
Maybe with the slightly less powerful vaccines, which aren't inducing quite such a strong immune response, the Delta agent is starting to break through, still maintaining some protection against the more severe end of disease. But, you know, it's clearly a sort of sliding scale now.
And the Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, J&J, and Sputnik V vaccines all seem to be better than Sinopharm and Sinovac at activating the body's second line of defense, called T cells.
A backup immune response, like a T-cell response, are going to provide better protection against diverse variants, viral variants, than an inactivated vaccine that only induces antibodies.
Still, Fuller says, the Sinopharm and Sinovac shots are much like the annual flu shot. Not perfect, but better than nothing, despite the complaints she hears every year.
I hear somebody gets a vaccine, they say, well, I'm never going to take it again because I got sick anyway. And my response is always this, is that, you know what, you would have been a lot sicker potentially in the hospital if you hadn't gotten the vaccine.
And she says all the shots help slow the spread of the virus, which means fewer chances for dangerous variants to evolve. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. New details are emerging about one of the Haitian-American men that have been arrested on suspicion of taking part in the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. Eve Johnson of Reuters News has that story.
A new U.S. connection emerged Monday in the investigation into the killing of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. A source with the Drug Enforcement Agency revealed that one of the suspects in the case, a Haitian-American man, had been a DEA informant. But a source in law enforcement said the man was not active as an informant at the time Moïse was gunned down in his home last Wednesday. The suspect is one of two Haitian-American men arrested last week. Police have also arrested a group of Colombian mercenaries and a Haitian man that police say was the mastermind of the plot. Washington has sent a team of experts to investigate Moïse's murder with a focus on any connection to the United States. Moïse's killing has plunged poverty-stricken Haiti into turmoil. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Monday expressed concern for the situation on the ground.
We urge the country's political leaders to bring the country together around a more inclusive, peaceful, and secure vision and pave the road toward free and fair elections this year.
Public anger erupted outside a courthouse in Port-au-Prince Monday. Two former lawmakers who had been critical of the president were brought in for questioning. The lawyer for one said the senators were anxious to cooperate.
The prosecutor wants to hear from us. The most important thing for the senators is justice for Jovenel Moïse, because they also want to know where this crime originated.
Neither of the senators have been charged.
Reuters reporter Eve Johnson. The Coast Guard is waving off U.S. residents who want to ferry supplies to protesting Cubans. Associated Press correspondent Rita Foley reports.
Groups of Cuban immigrants in Florida say they plan to travel to Cuba in boats filled with supplies to show support for street protesters on the island. Among the items mentioned, food, medicine, and guns. The Coast Guard says it's monitoring activity that would lead to what it calls unsafe and illegal crossings between Florida and Cuba. It calls the voyage dangerous and unforgiving. 20 Cubans have died recently trying to cross. Protesters took to the streets in Cuba over the weekend, marching against high prices and food shortages. I'm Rita Foley.
In Cuba, authorities are maintaining a strong presence in Havana, with police and security forces guarding the Capitol building. The Associated Press reports the streets are calm 2 days after thousands of people turned out to protest against the government in the center of the city. The protests were accompanied by acts of vandalism, the destruction of shops, attacks on police patrols, and violent arrests. Speaking in Philadelphia, U.S. President Joe Biden says America's democracy will be tested once again when the nation returns to the polls in 2022 and thus creates the need for voting rights legislation.
I'm not saying this to alarm you. I'm saying this because you should be alarmed. I'm also saying this. There's good news. It doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be, for real. We have the means. We just need the will. The will to save and strengthen our democracy.
Several states with Republican-led legislatures have passed restrictive measures following the 2020 election.
To me, this is simple. This is election subversion. It's the most dangerous threat to voting and the integrity of free and fair elections in our history. Never before have they decided who gets to count. Count. What votes count? Some state legislators want to make it harder for you to vote. And if you vote, they want to be able to tell you your vote doesn't count for any reason they make up. They want the ability to reject the final count and ignore the will of the people if their preferred candidate loses.
Republicans say that the laws they've passed are needed to shore up election integrity, although there has been no evidence of widespread fraud. The president is urging Congress to take action and pass the Voting Rights Advancement Act to counter the Republican-led efforts. Wildfires are burning across 10 western U.S. states. The blazes have torched homes and forced thousands to evacuate. AP correspondent Julie Walker has the details.
Nearly 60 wildfires tore through bone-dry timber and brush from Alaska to Wyoming. Oregon's bootleg fire has flames shooting 200 feet into the air and higher, with 0% containment, says Information Officer Daniel Omdahl.
This fire is extreme and beyond the capacity of even our very large air tankers.
California's largest fire, the Beckwith Complex, is burning over 91,000 acres with 26% containment. Incident Commander Rocky Applinger says conditions are tough for firefighters.
We've had 8 days of temperatures pushing 100 degrees. We've had extremely dry fuel conditions. We've had significant winds at the time that we couldn't fly any of our fixed-wing aircraft.
I'm Julie Walker.
The UN Refugee Agency warns Afghanistan is on the brink of another humanitarian crisis as escalating conflict is causing civilian casualties to rise and is driving hundreds of thousands of people to flee their homes in search of safety. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
More than 3.5 million people currently are displaced inside Afghanistan. Among them are an estimated 270,000 who have become newly displaced since the beginning of the year due to worsening security in the country. The UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan reports civilian casualties have risen 29% during the first quarter of this year compared to last. This increase corresponds with the U.S. troop withdrawal from the country. In addition to ongoing fighting, UN Refugee Agency spokesman Baba Baluch says many displaced people report fleeing because of harassment and extortion by armed groups, as well as lack of social services and loss of income due to rising insecurity.
Our concern is if this does not stop, numbers may be forced to seek safety inside the countries, but there's a potential risk that they may have to seek safety not even in the immediate neighboring countries, but beyond as well.
Baluch notes Iran and Pakistan host nearly 90% of more than 2 million registered Afghan refugees. He says the generosity and hospitality of these countries should not be taken for granted, as they have their own problems of development. The Taliban have been rapidly retaking land across Afghanistan as the U.S. troop withdrawal accelerates. On Friday, the rebel group claimed to be in control of 85% of Afghanistan after seizing key border crossings with Iran and Turkmenistan. Baluch says Afghan women are particularly fearful of losing the many gains they have made over the past 20 years if the Taliban come to power.
Women who finally found the space to breathe in Afghanistan, they're anxious, they're worried, and probably they're angry as well. They want peace and stability for their country. They don't want to go back to an era when there's no freedom for them.
Baluch says an examination of casualty figures shows an increasing proportion of women and children are victims of targeted killings. He says women activists and women journalists are at particular risk. The UNHCR is urging the international community to step up support to the government and people of Afghanistan at this critical time. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A notorious hacker group tied to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps has covertly targeted university professors and other experts seeking sensitive information. That's according to research by the cybersecurity firm Proofpoint. The security firm says the group known as TA-453 has been masquerading as British scholars at the University of London's School of Oriental and African Studies since at least January to approach their victims. The Proofpoint researchers said that while they could not independently confirm that the hacker group is part of the Revolutionary Guard, they assess with high confidence that it supports their intelligence collection efforts. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is a U.S.-designated foreign terrorist organization. Proofpoint did not disclose the names of the targets, but says it has worked with authorities to notify the victims. The U.S. intelligence community says it is most concerned about the cyber capabilities of Russia, Iran, China, and North Korea. In its latest assessment in April, the intelligence community said, quote, Iran's expertise and willingness to conduct aggressive cyber operations make it a significant threat to the security of the United States and allied networks and data. End quote.
This is Science in a Minute.
Ethiopian coffee has long been considered by many coffee connoisseurs to be the best in the world. Ethiopia has been famous for its everyday regular coffee to the most select specialty and gourmet blends. A new study on the effects of climate change on growing coffee beans in Ethiopia provides some possible good and bad news for coffee drinkers and producers. The study's lead author, Abel Chimura of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, says his team's computer simulations show that the area in Ethiopia known for producing average everyday coffee may slowly grow until sometime in the 2090s. For the bad news, Chimura says their study also shows areas known for producing the more profitable, high-quality coffee types will probably decrease if climate change continues unchecked. I'm VOA. Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A report by a nonprofit group says Africa needs to increase internet access to boost its economies, especially in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. The advocacy group found that while Africa's locally routed online traffic has increased, only 1 in 5 Africans has internet access. Mohamed Youssef reports that high taxes and frequent internet shutdowns by some African governments have also discouraged online trade.
The Internet Society Group says in a report this month, Africa's Internet Exchange Points, or IXPs, have increased from 19 to 46 in under 8 years. 6 countries have more than one IXP. An IXP is where multiple networks and service providers exchange internet traffic. The increase is significant because a decade ago, most African countries routed their online traffic outside the continent. Dawit Bekele is the Africa Regional Vice President for the Internet Society, a global non-profit organization that promotes the development and use of the internet. He says Africa having its own IXPs improves internet performance for users on the continent.
By developing internet exchange points within Africa, we have limited this kind of unnecessary travel of the internet traffic outside of Africa to come back to Africa, which has considerable advantage in improving the user experience, be it with the speed of connectivity or even the cost of connectivity.
The Washington-based group says its goal is to eventually have 80% of internet traffic in Africa be exchanged locally. Michael Nyitejeka, an information technology expert, says public demand has forced African governments to improve internet access.
We can't run away from the youth population. There are quite a number of young people, and therefore their affinity or drive for technology and use of internet is way higher than, let's say, our parents, and they would find it, they're more comfortable using technology than anything else. Finally, the other aspect that I think is quite critical is the access to technology. Mobile devices is definitely a big driver. We see quite a number of relatively cheap, smart or internet-enabled phones in our market. And that has had a massive effect on how many people can access the internet.
In a 2020 study, the International Foundation Corporation said internet users could add $180 billion to Africa's economies. However, some governments have taken steps to control digital communication by shutting down social media platforms and imposing a high tax on internet use. Omoniyi Kolande is the CEO of Cerebit, a Nigerian company that offers payment processing services to businesses. He says that government control of the internet will drive businesses backward.
It has been a way where we'll be driven backward instead of moving forward, right? We're supposed to actually encourage access. We're supposed to encourage collaboration and free access for interactions, for solutions, right? Because if businesses are to how to put their product on platform, right? As long as those platforms are being put down or disconnected, right, I think there's some loss of revenue at that point, right? And for payment gateway, we're already losing revenue as far as those businesses does not exist to achieve just the purpose of what they should achieve.
The United Nations Economic Commission for Africa notes that only 20% of the continent's population has access to the internet. The Internet Society Group is urging African governments to expand internet infrastructure to rural areas where most of the population lives so that they can benefit from it. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
The World Food Program is calling for greater access to Ethiopia's war-torn northern province of Tigray, noting that a convoy of food aid that reached the capital of Mekelle on Monday is not enough to meet growing needs. The WFP says that the food commodities transported to the region are only enough to feed about 200,000 people for a week. Agency spokesperson Tom Simfiri says that is not enough. He says the amount delivered falls far short for the nearly 4 million people who need emergency food aid in Tigray.
The food stocks and other emergency items just delivered and badly needed by the communities in Tigray will run out. And we need regular and faster deliveries into the region. We need 100 trucks to be moving in on any given day for half the time that we are to reverse the catastrophic humanitarian situation in the region.
The latest UN food assessment finds more than 400,000 people in Tigray are starving and another 1.8 million are on the verge of famine. The WFP is calling for greater access to Tigray and for more money. The UN Food Agency says it needs $176 million to continue to scale up its life-saving support to the people of Tigray until the end of the year. And finally, the European Union has announced its plan to cut emissions by 55% over the next decade. Reuters' Rosanna Philpon rounds us out.
It's called Fit for 55, a fitting name for the bloc's goal to slash 55% of its greenhouse gas emissions by 2030.
The race starts now. The 2020s is the make or break decade. And that's why Europe has committed to reduce our emissions by at least 55% by 2030 compared to 1990 levels.
Here's what it looks like. The European Commission will propose 12 policies targeting energy, industry, transport, and the heating of buildings. The list of proposals is long. Tougher EU CO2 emissions for cars could effectively ban sales of new petrol and diesel cars in 2035. EU countries will face more ambitious targets for expanding renewable energy. The measures aim to encourage companies and consumers to choose greener options. For example, a leaked draft of one proposal would tax polluting jet fuel for the first time and give low-carbon aviation fuels a 10-year tax holiday. A revamp of the EU carbon market is also expected to hike CO2 costs for industry, power plants and airlines and force ships to pay for their pollution. Brussels will also announce the details of its world-first carbon border tariff, targeting imports of goods produced abroad with high emissions, such as steel and cement. That has unnerved EU trading partners, including Russia and China. The political road ahead will likely be rough as EU countries and the European Parliament negotiate the proposals. Already, the plans have exposed familiar rifts between richer Western and Nordic EU states, where electric vehicle sales are soaring, and poorer Eastern countries that are worried about the social cost of weaning their economies off coal. Policymakers are also braced for a storm of industry lobbying.
Well, let us never forget what the cost of non-action would be.
Some of Europe's steel and cement sectors, due to be covered by the carbon border tariff, have said they don't want to be included. Brussels says it's time to take Europe's climate policies global. The World First package would also push EU industry to invest in expensive green technologies, giving European firms a competitive edge in global markets, and burnish the EU's global climate leadership position.
Reuters reporter Rosanna Philpott. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events by visiting our website. You can find us at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.